This is WJBC This Week.
I just feel so, I don't even know. I'm so happy.
It is awesome. Been waiting for it for a long time.
As a fan and as a business, definitely a collector's item.
He's the type of guy that didn't forget where he came from.
The FBI is, they have my confidence and they have the confidence, I think, of the American people.
I will sigh of relief when November 22nd is here and we've reached the, where we have zero substitution issues.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, the presidential campaign is down to its final days. We'll hear from a retired Illinois State University political science professor on the race, including the latest email controversy. Unit 5 settles its contract with its busing company, but district officials say they need to see more improvements. Finally, the Cubs are World Series champions. We'll hear from a reporter who was there for the Game 7 finale. And we'll hear from a coach from Eureka who helped mold World Series most valuable player, Ben Zobrist, into who he is today. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The presidential race has been tightening in the closing days of the campaign, with Hillary Clinton's edge over Donald Trump being trimmed on the heels of FBI Director James Comey's announcement that he was reopening the investigation into Clinton's emails. Retired Illinois State University political science professor Bob Bradley talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
Do you think because he is a man of high integrity ideals, that maybe he thought, if I don't, and it comes out that I had this information afterwards, and there was some damning evidence in one of these emails, then you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Right. He was in a very difficult position, and part of the position was because of what both candidates have done. I mean, it's sort of interesting. A lot of people said that the FBI director is maybe the only person in the country 1 week short of the election that brought Republicans and Democrats together in terms of criticizing the FBI. But he was in a very difficult position because I think partly he was concerned about a leak. And that a leak would have said, oh, there's been new evidence found or new information found in regard to this email scenario in regard to Clinton. And then why didn't he release it? But ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, he is not supposed to be subject and he's not supposed to be moved by political pressure. And he's in a position where, as many people have said already, he's supposed to take the heat, you know, and do what is right according to protocol and the law, not necessarily what he expects the public to want to hear.
So here we are, less than a week away, and they're out on the campaign trails pounding hard, and Hillary's going after him for his misogynistic ways, and that's all we heard yesterday. At least that's all I'm hearing on the sound bites. He's going right after the email. And wants to send her to prison. They're really not talking issues. With 5 days to go, is this what we're going to hear for the next, until Monday?
Yeah.
Through Monday?
Because why would things change? This is what all we've heard in the last few months. We've heard very little policy, particularly from the Trump side of the election. Clinton has gotten a little bit more into it, but not nearly as much as you would expect. The person who wants to become what many think is the most powerful person in the world. And there's a whole lot of things that we'd want to know. I mean, both have been talking about the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as many people call it. And both are not really satisfied with it. One wants to eliminate it completely. The other one wants to make significant revisions to it. But we haven't heard... What?
No, Trump says, I want to, it's the phrase that all you hear of Republicans all the time, repeal and replace. But they never tell you what they want to replace it with, what their plan is, other than, you know, erasing the borders and having a free market bring the prices down. That's
Right.
Trump's waiting.
And we don't, and we still don't, and Congress, the Republicans in Congress still have not come up with a plan that there's a consensus on from their side as to what they would replace the Affordable Care Act.
They've had
with.
Time. They've wanted to replace it since the day it was signed.
Right. They've had approximately 8 years to do this, and there still has not been a consensus on their side as to what they would replace it with. Immigration, really major problem, or at least a perceived problem by a lot of people. And, you know, what are we going to do other than build a wall?
Well, we've been talking about immigration reform for decades.
Right.
Nothing seems to get done. Is this just political fodder for an election cycle? It's one of those things that's brought up and it's a hot issue. People are paying attention. But then, you know, 2-3 years go by, nothing really gets done.
Well, part of the reason for that is the people that are most significantly affected by immigration reform are those that are the least, have the least resources to affect the political system. So ultimately, you cater to those, you say certain things to cater to those in power, but it subsides because the people that are most directly affected by it don't have any political power. And so you allow it to subside. It's similar to saying things about prison reform. And ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, the people that would be most affected by that really have
yeah,
no political power.
Right. They can't even vote.
Right.
Once they do serve time, you come back out. However, some states, I think, are looking at that. Other thing, you know, every political cycle, especially that when we're going to vote on the next president, entitlements. Affordable college education. I mean, every 4 years these things come up. Another perfect example, locally, on a state level anyway, the last gubernatorial race, how much time did they spend talking about minimum wage? And what has happened? They haven't even looked at it.
That's right.
They haven't even looked at it in 2 years.
Well, and there's a little bit more pressing problem called the not having a state budget.
Right,
and really, you shouldn't get into minimum wage until you start getting
right.
into a state budget.
But it's a big topic for the campaign trail, though.
Oh, yeah, right.
All right. Let's talk about your thoughts with these two candidates that are the presidential candidates disliked as much as they are. What's your gut feeling on voter turnout?
Right now, one of the things that I've paid attention to is early vote turnout. I mean, that's one of the major results of Bush versus Gore back in 2000. No state had early vote before 2000. Now 37 do. And this is ultimately where ground game does make a difference. And from the early vote turnouts, it's become pretty indicative that Clinton has a bigger, better ground game than Trump does in a lot of the states. And the early vote turnout is up quite a bit in a bunch of the states, and the turnout is favoring her in a bunch of the states. I think in a lot of ways this email controversy in sort of a unexpected way may help her, because she's saying, ah, the race is tightening, the polls, you know, national networks are tying into this, that the national polls are tightening. And that basically means that you're reducing that complacency that the Clinton forces might have had a week ago. And saying, boy, you got to get out and vote because of this new controversy. And that favors her, I think, in a lot of ways because of her strong ground game than more than it does him. So I think turnout in a lot of the states may be at a level of 2008 or better.
All right. We were talking briefly. Let's talk about, because we only have a few minutes left, all the other issues that are not getting the attention that you think they deserve, because we're all focused on these two, on ballots all across the country. Marijuana, legalization of marijuana, and how many states now they're looking at?
There's enough referendums across the country that medical marijuana may end up becoming, on November 9th, legal in the majority of states.
Medical marijuana.
Medical marijuana. Recreational marijuana is actually on the number of states that allow recreational marijuana may double by November 9th. The death penalty may be banned in the highest number of states since the founding of this nation. Because of the referendum. But on the other hand, this election has the lowest number lowest number of referendums that we've seen in quite a while. And people are trying to look at that. Why are the states making it so difficult to put referendums on the ballot?
Why do they make it so difficult for a candidate to run for office by asking them to him or her to acquire an ungodly amount of signatures? David Gill had to deal with that. What's your take on that? Is that too? Are they asking too much?
Yes, I think Illinois' laws in regard to becoming a candidate and voter registration are both antiquated in a variety of ways, and it would be really nice if we got into the 20th century on both of those things. One of the things that laws in this country are designed to do is make sure a third-party candidate doesn't have a realistic chance of getting into a high elected office. Redistricting is the same way. It's designed to make sure that the two parties are there, but never a third party.
You think we'll ever see legislation, whether it's legislation or a constitutional amendment, changing the way we draw the districts?
Well, we have seen things, and basically what we have seen in recent memory is to make sure that no one identified minority group is disadvantaged by drawing the electoral district lines. We've also seen that they have to be equal in population. We've also seen that they're supposed to look like the neighboring districts. That's one of the things that Illinois has a real difficulty with, because if you see a congressional map in Illinois, there's a bunch of districts that don't look like any of the other districts. In Illinois, but that's because we have a population center that just dominates the state, almost like unlike any other state in the country.
Want to make a prediction on the presidential race?
I think Clinton is going to win, and going to win pretty handily.
How about the Senate race with Tammy Duckworth and Kirk?
I think Duckworth may win by a bigger margin.
That was retired ISU politics professor Bob Bradley with Scott Laughlin. Unit 5 and its transportation provider, First Student, agreed to terms on a contract this week that'll keep the Ohio-based company in charge of the district's buses through the spring of 2018. This after a tumultuous start to the school year because of so many late and overcrowded buses and wrong drop-offs that had the district considering canceling its contract. Superintendent Mark Daniel talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
I bet you're taking a deep breath finally. Do you feel that way after the agreement was agreed to by First Student?
Well, I will sigh relief when November 22nd is here and we've reached the where we have zero substitution issues with drivers, and all routes are being filled by our drivers. That's truly the date. So, although I am relieved that we've come to an agreement of where we're heading and how we're going to get there now.
What changed from the constant problems that were happening to where things have started to get a lot better throughout the district? Was it a new leader within the company, or was it the pressure that was being put on them?
I think it's a combination of multiple factors. The increasing of the hourly wage from $14 to $16 an hour, the settlement of the labor contract with First Student between First Student and AFSCME. Also, with those combinations, the routing was slowly being resolved, and there are still issues there, but now we have drivers to place in the buses, in our buses, and those drivers then can start working on improving timeliness. And that's in direct relationship to number of drivers available.
I'm going off memory here, but I believe your contract with First Student for busing goes through 2018. Is that correct?
That's correct. June 2018.
What will happen in the future to prevent other problems from popping up within that 2-year period?
Well, part of their we've told them we need to be insured of a percentage of drivers that are substitute drivers, and that means they're constantly in the recruiting phase, and it's just inherent with that particular workforce. Drivers obtain CDLs and Some want a full-time job, and it may be indifferent and not driving a bus. So you're constantly having to be out there pushing and inquiring and seeking and finding drivers. So they had their bus fare this past weekend, and I understand they had 16 applications. So that's something that has to happen, because those 16 applications may boil down to maybe five drivers that actually enter the program. So that is just a constant, and I would really like for Unit 5 in Bloomington Normal to be the hub of substitute drivers, and then other districts contact First Student here at Unit 5 and if they need substitute drivers. So I'm just really pleased and grateful for the way the community has responded, though, in regards to the number of applicants. And I think that was a response to the needs of our families and our students.
This has been an incredibly frustrating time for you, and I know that because you've done a great job of coming in and talking to the public here on WJBC. Do you think that the next step is really a PR one, where the trust has to be earned back from some parents that are pretty upset still?
I absolutely think there's a trust factor there, and I think that has to be earned, and that's earned by having buses that are timely. And if we do have a problem situation, then that communication is going to our parents. And we're working on that whole process of how do we expedite that? How do we ensure that? And what is the range? Is it maybe between 10 and 15 minutes? A bus may be late 10 and 15 minutes. Do we contact parents? And or is it after that? Is it maybe 15 to 20 minutes? And we're working on that type of scenario. But I'll tell you another thing. We need our building principals to be able to contact our bus drivers or our buses directly. So we're working on that phenomenon as well. So I really want that relationship to be strong between my building principals or their designees, as well as the drivers that are coming to those buildings that are picking up our students. I think that's something that we're going to begin actually immediately, and having that discussion with First Student Management. So you're right. We need to earn that trust again, and that will be done by ensuring that buses are on time and parents don't have to have that, well, is a bus going to be here on time or not? And if a bus is going to be late, that we have identified that range, parents understand that, and if it's in that critical range, we get that phone call, we get that message out to our parents.
And I think the GPS aspect of the agreement is probably going to bring a lot of peace of mind as far as knowing where each bus is.
Yes. And again, there are some quirks to that, but for the majority of our buses, the GPS system, we call it MyStop, parents should be able to track their son or daughter's bus. And that does bring about a great amount of peace of mind. And I think we're also looking at adding some more technology to that piece in regards to, as we scan students as they enter a bus, they scan. We know who's riding the bus, and we know ridership. So another way for us to, again, communicate efficiently and hopefully very quickly with our parents if there are questions. And, again, our building principals being able to contact drivers directly instead of having to go through dispatch or someone at First Student. So we're breaking down those, I call those walls, improving that communication. But again, boils down to you can talk all you want, but we need action, and that action is going to gain our respect.
Absolutely. Superintendent Mark Daniel, just one last question for you. I know that one thing you were very concerned about was students missing class time.
Yeah.
And do you feel that they have missed out on part of their education, and how do we get those kids caught up?
Well, we have specifically addressed that. This primarily at the high school, so the area, and our principals have worked with guidance counselors trying to address, and we've with teachers to identify specific students. So we've been extending opportunities to those students. We're wanting teachers to And I have to tell you, Unit 5 teachers are phenomenal in regards to the way they work with our students, continue to give them opportunities as well as options. But we're having after-school tutoring sessions that are happening. We're providing that bus service to students that say they wouldn't have that service available. We've made as many switches as we can in their actual schedules, did that early on. But that still concerns me. And, again, we're coming to an end of a quarter. Students will start receiving progress reports, that sort of thing, and we need to address that. And if there are concerns, I think we need to look at each individual student and treat them with a unique solution. So we're in that process, we're in that phase. But again, if students are, as we've identified, we're hoping that we can meet the majority of those kids.
That was Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel with Terry James. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. As the late Chicago Cubs broadcaster Jack Brickhouse once famously said, any team can have a bad century. After 108 years of futility, things are looking up in Chicago as the Cubs won the World Series this week after an epic Game 7 win over the Cleveland Indians. In the morning after the win, Illinois Radio Network sports director Jason Gotch talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
It sure seems like it really the apocalypse is almost here, because they needed everything and then some to actually finish it off and actually win the final game of the World Series.
When you're sitting there with all your other broadcasters, all your other journalists, were you all questioning Joe Maddon's move to bring in Lester?
Yes, I think most people were. The fellow sitting next to me works for a Canadian station. He goes, I can't believe he's doing this.
Even a Canadian?
Yeah, I can. Well, the thing I thought is, okay, well, he's being a little over-cautious here because Lester's been so good, just trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. But, boy, oh, boy, I mean, Lester is, Hendricks is doing a great job. He settled down after a little bit of a shaky start. I mean, it seemed like it was a panic button, really, Scott, that whole game. I mean, the talk is the Cubs won the World Series, so everybody's going to remember. But if the Cubs had not won this game, Joe Maddon would have been talked about like Steve Bartman for some of the moves that he had pulled throughout Game 7. I mean,
I think you're absolutely
Chapman,
right.
Because Chapman, I mean, coming in early, oh, my goodness.
And his, I don't care what you say, his arm's got to be tired, Chapman's arm. He obviously didn't have the stuff because they were hitting him. And it just takes...
I don't think there's any doubt about it. I don't think there's any doubt about it. He didn't have the stuff. I mean, a guy hadn't been used to being worked like that. But maybe the most remarkable thing about this whole thing is that after all that, Joe Maddon sent Aroldis Chapman out there for the ninth inning and somehow he got through it. I could not believe that Aroldis Chapman was going out there for the ninth inning. I expect maybe Jake Arrieta, maybe John Lackey, one of the stars. And Chapman comes out and tells you, like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And somehow that actually worked out. And it defies explanation.
No,
really.
You know, when Chapman got in a little trouble, and I'm sitting there and I'm blaming Maddon. I'm not blaming Chapman. I'm blaming Maddon. And I'm sitting there and I'm not saying it out loud internally. I was beside myself. Why would he make these moves that he's making right now? Made no sense to me.
It really was over. I mean, it was, to me, it was overmanaging. That's what it came down to. I mean, at some point, you got to trust these guys more than he did within those two situations. I mean, okay, well, you pull Hendricks for Lester, and then, okay, Lester's there in the eighth inning. He allows somebody on base, and you're just going to push the panic button right there on John Lester, who you think is your best pitcher? I mean, it didn't make much sense. You know what? Somehow it worked out. I think the biggest thing was, maybe God really is a Cubs fan, because as crazy as the bottom of the eighth through the ninth inning was, I think that rain of about 20 minutes, you know, Jason Hayward there pumping guys up in the dugout, giving a speech. I, I think that kind of took the momentum away from Cleveland. Shaw, the pitcher, had to come out after working the ninth and the break and then do the tenth. I think that really it kind of reset the game. Let's just put it that way. It kind of dampened things, and we were just starting a new game. And the next thing you know, the Cubs offense steps up, and they've won the World Series. I mean, I guess it was supposed to be that way, though. You wait 108 years. That's the way it's supposed to happen, I guess.
All right. So Zobrist gets most valuable player. And let me ask you this. Let's you be the coach now. Where do you put Schwarber next year?
I think he gets to play left field. I really believe that. I believe that for a long time, Scott, because I know he wants to catch, but he was never a good defensive catcher, number one, and he's had a major knee injury. So why would you put him there? You can't put him at first base because Rizzo is cemented there for many years to come. The left field is really the easiest position to play of the outfield positions. Can't play center. He's not going to play right because that's tough, tricky with the long throws to the second and third. I think you got to put him at third. I'm sorry. I think you got to put him in left field. I mean, Bryant's a third. I guess you could work him as a third baseman, maybe play Bryant in the outfield, but that doesn't make much sense either at this point. I think you teach him to play left field, and you hope he is below average to average defensive player. You live with it because he's got the great bat.
So what do you do with the World Series MVP?
That's a good question, too. I would think that – I think you keep Baez at second. Maybe – I mean, we'll see what happens with Jason Hayward. I know Dexter Fowler's got a mutual player option. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is if Fowler goes – then maybe Hayward slides over to center and you put Zobrist in right field. I mean, Zobrist can play anywhere, but I don't see how Javier Baez doesn't play second. Russell is short. I mean, I would think that would make the most sense. If Fowler's not back, Hayward in center and Zobrist in right.
That was Illinois Radio Network Sports Director Jason Gotch with Scott Laughlin. Now, the World Series MVP Ben Zobrist had his hometown of Eureka overflowing with pride. Zobrist was a multi-sport standout in Eureka, who later went on to win World Series titles with the Kansas City Royals last year and now the Cubs this year. His coach in junior high was Craig Gerdes, and he talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
In baseball, he was my pitcher shortstop. In basketball, he was my point guard. And in track, he was a high jumper and a long-distance runner.
Understood when he went to college, he became a pretty good football player on top of all the rest of that.
Yeah, good football. And he also ran some cross country in high school. He was just one of those kids that could do most anything that he wanted to.
Yeah, and he's a great person. I mean, he's grown up to be. And that maybe makes people from this area feel as good as what has happened in the World Series for him.
Yeah, I always say that. A lot of people think of him as a great athlete and all these things that he's done in baseball, but he's also a wonderful person and a great young man. He's the type of guy that didn't forget where he came from. He comes back to Eureka. If there's a fundraiser to go on, he will donate something to the fundraiser. He's that guy that when he left home, he didn't change. He remembered where his roots were, and he stayed the same level-headed person that he always was.
That's it. We've all kind of known about him, but when he became a Chicago Cub, we learned more about him. And then, of course, after this past week or so, it's like, that's our Ben Zobrist. We all kind of lay a little claim to you. What'd you think last night when they won the series?
Well, it was a great game to watch. It was a little bit late for me to stay up. I'm usually about a 9:30 to 10 o'clock bed goer, but naturally I stayed for the whole thing. And he had gone 0-for-4 until that 10th inning hit, but all four times he was hitting the ball hard. So I had a lot of confidence in him in that 10th inning. Also, he's the type of guy, he doesn't care if he has two strikes on him. He's just as good a hitter with two strikes as anything else. And I guess what I love about him the most is I always say that baseball is a man's game, but you've got to have a lot of little boy in you to play it. And he's always had a lot of little boy in him. You know, naturally, when he was in seventh and eighth grade, you are a little boy,
yeah.
So you've got little boy in you. But the way he jumps around and celebrates, and he just acts like a little boy out there that loves what he does. He loves the game.
And anybody watching him gets that. They absolutely do. And then he's named MVP. I was a little surprised, but after the first game of the series, after he had such a good NLCS, I put my money on him, and I said, you know, this guy's going to come through. What'd you think when he won the MVP?
Well, as you said, early in the postseason, he was struggling a little bit against the Giants and the Dodgers. I flew out to Los Angeles to see three of the games between the Cubs and the Dodgers. So I got to see those games out there and got to be with him a little bit before the game each night. We either gave each other a thumbs up or we tipped our cap to each other or we did some little signs and so forth. But when the World Series started, he really got his stroke back. And after the first couple games, I said, you know, if he keeps this up, he's got a chance at Most Valuable Player. And when he went 0-for-4 last night, I thought, he may lose out on it. But the moment he got that game-winning hit, I thought that might get him over the hump. And sure enough, it did. But, you know, MVP naturally stands for Most Valuable Player, but with Ben, it could also be Most Valuable Person because he's just a great person too.
Yeah, and that's what makes that's the icing on top of the cake. He's such a nice guy. So has the realization hit you yet that you may have started Ben Zobrist in junior high, middle school, and you've seen him go from that to what he is now,
yeah.
And you play a part in that. Do you ever see yourself as being, this is so cool for me?
Yeah. Well, you know, to kind of answer your question, he was 5 foot in the 7th grade, 5'3" in the 8th grade. He had all the determination, the work ethic, the talent that you needed. But he was just so small. Somebody would say to me, do you think he can be a major leaguer? And I thought to myself, no, he's just too small. And then in high school and college, he got up to 6'3", and then he had the size to go along with everything else. So there's just a lot of special things about him, and I guess nothing that he ever did surprised me. In basketball, if we needed a basket, he'd be the guy that would get it for you. If you needed a hit late in the game, he'd get it. If you needed to lay down a bunt, he could do it. He always could kind of come up with what you needed.
I would guess you would, the old worn-out phrase is he's a coachable kid. I'm betting he was one of the better coachable kids you ever had.
Yeah. You know, as I said, as a student in the classroom, he was an A-B student and mainly all A's, just occasionally would get a B. So he was the good kid along with the good athlete. The story goes that when he was in grade school, the only time he would get in trouble is during lunch hour. When the kids were dismissed for lunch, he wanted to be the first one in line. So he'd run through the halls so he could be the first in line. But that just went along with his athletic ability. He had so much drive and determination, he wanted to be the first in everything.
Yeah. Have you talked to him since last night?
I have not talked to him. The last time I talked to him was either out in L.A., or with a text message. When I left L.A., I told him they left L.A. with a 3-2 lead, I believe, over the Dodgers. And I said, okay, I got you a 3-2 lead out here. You're going to have to do it the rest of the way. And he texted me back. He said, I may have to get a couple airplane tickets for you to Cleveland. I might need you in Cleveland. Well, I didn't see those airplane tickets, so I never got to Cleveland. But I will probably text him in the next day or two. He's just being swarmed now.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll probably tell him, you know, great job, good work ethic, loved seeing what I saw, and just proud of you as both a person and a player.
Oh, that's absolutely – and not only you, you, of course, because you have the relationship with – I think everybody around here just is so proud of him because he's not – he's a great athlete. He's an MVP of the World Series. He's a solid guy. He's a Christian guy. And that, I mean, it's the whole package. Yeah. And you can't get that out of everybody anymore.
Yeah. To give you two examples, I play golf every day at noon on Monday through Friday. We're all retired guys between 60 and 95. And all the old, I call them old guys, I'm 67, but some of the guys are 80, 90, 95. They always want to ask me questions about Ben Zobrist. You know, they love him just because of what they see, his attitude, etc. On Thursday mornings, I go to the AC nursing home in Eureka, and I have coffee with the old men that are in their 80s and 90s. And this morning I was there, all they wanted to talk about was Ben Zobrist. So you could be a grade school kid at 6 years old or in the nursing home at 92, and you still love Ben Zobrist. That's the kind of guy he is.
Very good. Coach Craig Gerdes, who was Ben Zobrist's baseball coach in junior high.
7th and 8th grade.
At Eureka, correct?
Right.
Was it consolidated to...
Yeah, we have Eureka, Goodfield, and Congerville, okay. All three towns. Once they get into 5th grade, they all come together. And then I was a 7th grade teacher and the 7th and 8th grade coach.
What a story. And he's touched so many lives in a positive way. You're just so happy when you see good things happen.
Yeah, it just... You know, there's nothing nicer than when good things happen to good people.
That was Craig Gerdes, one of Ben Zobrist's coaches at Eureka with Dan Sweeney. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. 108 years later, a team known for so long as the lovable losers are World Series champions. WJBC's Adam Stasinski had fan reaction.
The Cubs prevailed 8-7 in a wild 10-inning World Series Game 7. Lifelong Cub fan Brian Netherton says only one thing was on his mind after the Cubs' final out.
Out of my mind. It's 108 years. They deserved it. They fought and they fought and they fought and they beat them, and this is time to party.
Nick Rathke could barely describe his emotions after watching the game at Maggie Miley's in Uptown Normal.
I've been a Cubs fan my entire life. I don't know what to say. I'm just so happy they finally won. My entire life, I've been waiting for this day.
Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
And Cubs fans have been lining up to buy their World Series champion gear. Some of it is being made in Bloomington. Minerva Promotions screen printed 6,000 Cubs World Series champion T-shirts in the hours after the Cubs won the title. Owner Tony Todaro says it means a lot to him as a lifelong Cubs fan.
I will frame one, definitely. You know, for me, it's a collector's item just because I have not only a business and emotional attachment to it, but it's just very important for myself.
Minerva previously produced Super Bowl T-shirts for the Indianapolis Colts when they won the title in 2007. Former McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen struck a plea agreement with the federal government this week. WJBC's Terry James reported he was in Chicago federal court on Wednesday.
Sorensen was indicted on federal charges, accusing him of fraud, along with co-defendant Navdeep Arora, that accused the two of filing fraudulent invoices to several clients, including State Farm in Bloomington. Sorensen is pleading guilty to one count of wire fraud and will be responsible for paying back nearly $250,000 in restitution. Sorensen faces up to 20 years behind bars. A sentencing hearing will be held in March. The indictment accuses Sorensen of keeping at least $400,000 in consulting fees after the two created a couple shell companies. Terry James, WJBC and WJBC.com.
The political firestorm rages on after FBI Director James Comey reopened the Bureau's investigation into Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton's handling of emails. Based on his experience as a federal prosecutor, Congressman Ray LaHood thinks the Bureau is on target.
These are some of the best people that we have working for our government, quality, dedicated, committed people to this country. And I have lots of confidence in the FBI and Director Comey And you know, I think they're doing their due diligence. They're doing what they're supposed to.
LaHood says Democrats, who are now slamming the FBI for reopening the investigation 1 week before the election, are being hypocritical. A Bloomington man who stabbed two people and beat a third person in a broad daylight attack in downtown Bloomington in August of last year has been found not guilty by reason of insanity. 36-year-old Jason Hopkins has been returned to the state mental hospital where he had been getting treatment after he was found unfit to stand trial. Hopkins has been charged with attempted murder and aggravated battery. Bloomington Normal is not immune to human trafficking. That was a message at an awareness event in Bloomington this week. Catalyst Ministries President Julie Ryan says many times an Asian massage parlor will be used as a front for these organizations.
Looking at Chicago and other places like that, Chicago is a large hub for women to be trafficked into the country, into the state.
Ryan estimates 100,000 women and children are trafficked into the country each year. She says her organization works with authorities to assist victims of human trafficking. And McLean County has seen a 48% increase in drunk driving arrests so far this year. Sheriff John Sandage believes that's a good thing because it means police across the county are getting drunk drivers off the road.
On our side at the sheriff's office, I know we've got a lot of deputies who have they've really doubled down and they're refocusing their efforts and they're doing a great job of getting intoxicated motorists off the road.
Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. And now we take a look ahead at the week to come. Tuesday is Election Day. WJBC will have the results and analysis with CBS News and the WJBC News team once the polls close at 7 p.m. On Wednesday, the Red Cross of the Heartland will host its annual Heroes Breakfast, and WJBC will present its Don Munson Spirit of McLean County Award winner. Also Wednesday, Eureka College will hold its annual Fall of the Berlin Wall ceremony with a former White House Chief of Staff to speak. Friday is Veterans Day. Illinois State University will announce the winner of its high-tech game of Capture the Flag to test students' skills in information security. Also Friday, the Illinois State men's and women's basketball teams will open their seasons. The men visit Murray State. The women travel to Arizona State. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Starr.